previously on Unsolved.
But I did talk about experience he had with a possessed person in his office there, in the chancery office. There was a crucifix on the wall, but when you opened the door, it would cover the crucifix. And a woman came in who was very distressed and was very troubled, and Father Quinn told me about the time that she was just very, very angry because she knew it was around summer, but she couldn't find the crucifix.
And I remember him insisting that he was absolutely convinced that Father Coons was killed by Luciferians, you know, Satanists.
From the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, this is Unsolved, Season 3, The Devil You Know. I'm Gina Barton. In the weeks before Father Alfred Coons was murdered, there had been a series of church burglaries around central and southern Wisconsin. Father Coons' best friend, Father Charles Fiore, did a television interview about that theory. He seemed to think Father Coons' death resulted from a burglary gone wrong.
I want the person who did it to be caught. I would like to know why, what they wanted from him. Was it a simple break-in and a burglary? Were they looking for something?
And retired detective Don Johnson tells me the police considered that theory pretty seriously.
Like, if somebody broke in there and was going to do a burglary theft, okay, they were looking for money, booze, whatever, and then it gets interrupted, all right, well, who are the burglars and guys like that that are out there doing those crimes that may have gotten pushed into a murder here? And the really interesting thing back then is there was a group of people that were breaking into churches and stealing valuable things. So that was actually a hot tip to be working on that.
Eventually, the police did track down a burglar who knew Father Coons and who had been to St. Michael for Latin Masses. To tell this part of the story, we have to go all the way back to 1949, to the tiny town of Nisida, Wisconsin. At the time, a woman named Mary Ann Van Hoof lived on a farm there with her husband and their kids. She said that in November of 1949, she saw the Blessed Virgin Mary in the doorway of her bedroom. As you can imagine, this caused quite a stir. In the early 1950s, Mary Ann Van Hoof did some interviews about what she saw with a priest named Father Leo Sheets. Father Sheets wrote about those interviews, and he said he recorded them. Unfortunately, I couldn't find copies of those recordings anywhere. I did find transcripts, though, and I've asked some journalist friends to read from them for you.
Whenever I'm afraid, anything scares me, I get frightened, I pray the Hail Mary. As I prayed the Hail Mary, this figure came into my room and stopped about 4 feet from my bed. It didn't say anything. It just looked sad watching me. It was sort of bluish, light-colored in front. Its face was down. It didn't say anything. How long it stood there, I don't remember because I was too terrified, too frightened to remember anything else about it. When I couldn't take it any longer, I turned my back to it. When I peeked back to see if it was still there, it was gone.
Then Father Sheets asked Mary Ann about May 28th, 1950, when she says the Virgin Mary came back. And this time, she spoke.
I had just called my husband to dinner. I stooped over to brush a mosquito from my leg. It had been biting. I saw a flash of light, sort of like when the sun reflects across a windshield. Thinking a car drove up outside, I looked and saw a blue mist behind the four little ash trees out there.
Then you went out to the trees?
I went out. And as soon as I went out, this blue mist floated through the tips of the trees and then formed into Our Lady.
Will you give me a description of how Blessed Mother looked to you when you saw her?
She had a blue veil on, a blue robe, a cream-colored gown with a golden cord around her neck, which has on the one end a globe and on the other end a large tassel. And she had a large crucifix, large rosary in her hand with a crucifix, about 4 or 5 inches. It had a special glow and shine to it, and the wounds on it are like real blood.
Early on, people really believed this was a miracle. Mary Ann said the Blessed Mother had given her a schedule. saying she would be coming back to Nisida on August 15th and October 7th, 1950. And on both of those days, between 80,000 and 100,000 people went to Nisida. And Mary Ann stood with a microphone and gave them what she said were the messages from the Virgin Mary. I actually found a video of this on YouTube, and it's so interesting. I've posted a link for you at our website, jsonline.com/unsolved. I also put up some pictures there of Mary Ann and the crowds that day. But again, there was no audio. So here's our narrator again, reading part of the transcript from August 15th.
The time is here when we must save ourselves. Save yourselves, my dear children. Sisters and priests, remember your commandments our Lord has given you. Do not forget them. Remember them. Many of you only think of prayer in time of illness. The time is here, now. We cannot forget God. Only our Lord can save you. Nothing else will. So you must pray, pray, pray hard.
On October 7th, the message was more of a warning.
When the enemy of God comes down with his destruction, you will scream, but it will be too late. Stop your mockery of our Lord. Stop it. You must love God, not mock him. How do you mock him? By disobeying your commandments, by forgetting the way of the cross, the crucifixion, the scourging. That's how you mock him, with blasphemy.
Over time, the things Mary Ann was attributing to the Virgin Mary got more and more bizarre, like saying Satan is running the United Nations, saying doctors have the cure for cancer, but they're giving people these other chemicals so the cure doesn't work, saying the communists have taken over the Catholic Church in America. So people started to think these messages probably really weren't from the Virgin Mary. Father Sheets asked Mary Ann about some of this controversy.
Would you have any answer for those persons who seem to think this might not be coming from our Blessed Lady, but from Satan?
I've had those questions put to me before. Satan would not ask for the rosary. Satan would not give the messages she does, that I have for the priests and the Pope and the bishops. Those sure would not be the work of Satan, because he would just be doing the opposite instead of asking for prayer.
Eventually, two Roman Catholic bishops, one in 1955 and one in 1975, denounced Mary Ann Van Hoof's visions as fake. The church leaders told people to stop saying she had received these messages from the Virgin Mary. A lot of Catholics did as they said, but a core group of about 150 families refused, and they weren't looked on too kindly by the Catholic Church. Anyway, Mary Ann Van Hoof said she continued to have these visions for 39 years, until shortly before her death in 1984. And a bunch of people have said miracles happened to them while they were praying at the site where the Virgin Mary was said to have appeared. They call it the Sacred Spot. There's a shrine on the site now. Father Kuntz was tied to the shrine in a couple of different ways. Maureen O'Leary, whom he hired as principal of St. Michael's School, lived very close to the shrine. Father Kuntz knew a lot of people who believed in the visions. He was also one of only a few priests who still welcomed the shrine followers at his church, even though they had defied the bishop's orders to stop saying that Mary Ann Van Hoof's sightings of the Virgin Mary were real. He also went down there sometimes to help the people settle disputes about church law. So I went out to the shrine one day last summer. I brought along one of our interns, Taylor. The shrine is about 80 miles away from Dane, where Father Kuntz was murdered. There's a huge construction site where Mary Ann Van Hoof's farmhouse used to be, and volunteers have been working for decades to build a heart-shaped cathedral there. Mary Ann said the Virgin Mary showed her the blueprints for it. It still doesn't look like much. A construction site, a couple of sets of stairs, no walls to speak of, and no roof.
I wish we could go up there.
There are also 14 grottos with life-size statues. There's the crucifixion, the Last Supper, and also different saints, like Saint Michael the Archangel, Joan of Arc, and Mother Cabrini, who served the poor in Chicago in the 1800s and early 1900s. As Taylor and I walked around, a guy came up to us. He said his name was Brother Joseph.
Yeah, I got something for you.
For us?
I was in sixth grade in Milwaukee in 1971. Uh-huh. You know what a Polaroid camera is?
Yeah.
Uh-huh. All right, so I was a little kid and I took pictures. You guys taking pictures. I took one up and got to the sacred spot where the Blessed Mother appeared.
Uh-huh.
And
Right there?
Them four ash trees, they were little.
Okay.
The lady come out of her house, swatted a mosquito, and then she looked up and you look at that throttle, you see a ray came down marking the spot.
Huh.
Anyway, so I take this picture and nothing came out. You know, I didn't see nothing. But when it came out, there was something on it.
He showed us what he said was a copy of this Polaroid. And it showed a picture of Jesus. He said he had put together a website so the whole world could see it and hear about all the miracles he'd experienced.
I was a big partier, you know. I had a little trip to hell. But I was in L.A. and an amplifier hit my knee. And so I came here on the Feast of St. Patrick, 1986, and Jesus fixed my knee. 7 years, I couldn't bend it. I'm Irish. And then...
What?
Yeah, then I was in an accident.
Wait.
I couldn't bend it. I had to go to County Hospital in Milwaukee, and an intern kind of screwed up the surgery.
Uh-huh.
And I couldn't bend it for 7 years. And right on the Feast of St. Patrick, Jesus fixed it.
You were here.
Right here. Just thousands of miracles here. I put miraculous metal on one guy. He was blind. He could see.
Yeah.
My sister died at 43. She had scleroderma. She used to drink a lot of diet soda. And she was practically dead. And I came in with the relic of the cross. I have a relic of the true cross. And
you
right in front of the black lady.
How'd you get that?
I got it from the Bishop of Rome. I make friends with priests. And then when they're ready to die, they give me everything. But anyway, my sister was practically dead. And I came with the relic of the cross. She opened her eyes and sat up. The more famous one for me is I was in a car accident and I had a spinal injury. The third disc, went to the Marshfield Clinic and Mayo Clinic. They all said, we're going to have to fuse your spine. You'll never walk again. And I did. I suffered for 1 year. I was going to die. And I came here. They dragged me here on the Feast of St. Joseph. And I took the name Joseph of the Most Blessed Trinity. I'm a Carmelite brother. And right at the sacred spot, I asked for a cure. I'm going to die. And on the Feast of St. Joseph, March 19th, I got fixed in 1986.
Taylor and I walked around the shrine for a couple of hours. Brother Joseph was puttering around the whole time, touching up paint on the various grottos, pulling weeds, stuff like that. Every once in a while, he would come over and tell us something else. He told us the Virgin Mary, through Marianne Van Hoof and other messengers, had made a bunch of predictions.
All the prophecies have come true. 1970, it said all eyes would be on the Persian Gulf. That happened, Gulf War. 1975, Syria holds the solution to the key to peace or the start of the Third World War. Syria, that's 40 years ago. So anyway, they've all come true.
I asked Brother Joseph if he had actually met Marianne Van Hoof, and he said no. But he said he's a caregiver for an old man who knew her. He called the man Brother Francis.
Francis was up here in the meeting. He had 12 rosaries turned to gold. He saw the miracle of the sun.
Can he talk to us?
Yeah, he's pretty old now.
Brother Joseph told us Brother Francis was waiting in the car. So we started walking over there to talk to him. Now, let me tell you about this car. This car was really something. It was an old station wagon painted in bright primary colors, to the point where you couldn't even tell what the original color was. And it was just covered in Bible verses and warnings about Satan. The passenger window was rolled down because it was hot, and there was an elderly man sitting there. He was wearing one of those jungle hats, like from the Jurassic Park movies, and it had mosquito netting hanging down over his face. His chin was resting on his chest, and he was snoring.
Francis!
Hi.
Hey. They want to hear about all the miracles. Did you see anything good up here? Come on, enlighten me.
Were you here when Marianne was seeing the apparitions?
Oh, yeah. When I joined the inner circle, it was one of the results of being in the inner circle. Yeah, go right in to see her and
ecstasy. So he witnessed it.
I witnessed.
Brother Francis couldn't tell us too much more about that. Apparently, the day we talked to him was his 96th birthday. But Brother Joseph told us Marianne would go into these trances.
The Blessed Mother revealed through Marianne in her suffering. She had the stigmata, the wounds, the crown. And right in that house, five men couldn't bend her arms. She was pinned to that cross. Mm-hmm. You couldn't see the cross.
Right.
Anyway, in her suffering during Lent, she would reveal stuff.
A woman working in the Shrine gift shop told us that when she was a kid, she had seen Marianne suffering for herself. This woman also told us about the miracle of the sun and about people's rosaries turning to gold. Both of these things have reportedly happened at other sightings of the Virgin Mary, ones that actually were approved by the Catholic Church. During the miracle of the sun swirls around and different colors of light come out of it. With the rosaries, the links in the chain changed from a silver color to a gold color. The last thing Brother Joseph told us was that Marianne Van Hoof had predicted some sort of apocalypse.
There was a message up here in 81, and Marianne said, millions of evil people will die, many good will die with them. And there was a long pause, and she said, a few good will remain. So there you go. So nobody knows but the Father, but there's a little flicker of hope for you that it's going to continue. Marianne said, there's a supernatural arch, a golden dome over the sacred spot. And they say there's like for 30 miles it's protected. This is like the original refuge spot, 1950.
He told Taylor and me that when this disaster happens, we can come to his place to be sure we're protected. He told us it's easy to find, and we'll know it's the right place because he's put up a big billboard of his Jesus Polaroid at the end of the driveway to advertise the website where he talks about the prophecies.
I've been, you know, promoting stuff. Mm-hmm. And anyway, I live right down, if things ever get bad, I'm right down the railroad tracks. This is called Shrine Road.
Uh-huh.
If you go up to that first road, that 16th, it comes up to the railroad tracks, and you'll see I got my picture, a big 30-footer out there. But all the punks throw rocks at it and beer bottles and smash it.
Oh.
But then that wasn't enough. Then they came after my house, and they broke all my windows.
Oh, my gosh.
See, they got them big rocks at the railroad tracks, and so they probably closed the bars and come and just pelt the cops don't even come. They came a couple times, an hour or two later.
Well, they should come if they're throwing rocks.
They got up on my roof and smashed my skylights.
Oh, my God.
So now I got 36 surveillance cameras, and they still come.
As we were getting ready to leave, it looked like Brother Joseph was packing up, too.
Are you leaving?
I'm cleaning up. We got to get home and work on my roof before the rain. Okay. We got to
from the kids.
Smash your windows, huh?
From the kids smashing.
I don't know. I think they're old. They're hardcore Satanists. You know, I'm going to kill you and they do all that. But hopefully if the cameras will catch them.
Is there a lot of that around here?
None.
Huh.
I didn't lock my door for 30 years.
Yeah. Oh, wow.
But, you know, whatever is a shine of purity, Satan moves in.
Right.
Whatever something's holy, Satan moves in.
Right.
Okay. Now back to the Father Kuntz murder investigation. One of the shrine followers who sometimes went to St. Michael was a guy named Jeffrey Moss. He was the guy I talked about at the top of the show, the one who became a suspect in the murder after he got caught burglarizing statues from churches around central and southern Wisconsin. He got caught after he took a statue from Holy Assumption Church in West Allis, which is a Milwaukee suburb. And he apparently did this while a funeral was going on. One of the mourners saw him putting a big, bulky object wrapped in a sheet into the trunk of his Chevy Chevette. Another tipster told the police Jeffrey Moss had been building a shed out in Nisida. In that shed, and in two more that he rented, the police found 29 statues and a bunch of other stuff from churches. They also found an underground bunker and a bunch of survival supplies like oatmeal and rifles. Jeffrey Moss ended up pleading guilty to 9 charges and was sentenced to probation. I told Taylor about all this after we left the shrine, while we were having lunch at the only restaurant we could find in Nisida, which was a Subway. I found an address for Jeffrey Moss on one of the databases we use. So after we were done eating, Taylor and I went to try to find his house and see if he would talk to us.
No, 98.
Yep. We got kind of lost. There were a lot of dead ends, and the GPS kept getting confused.
I don't know what my GPS wants me to do, because...
It wants you to turn on 18th Ave. Isn't that right where we were? Or is it a different dead end?
We put it in after.
Then, Taylor saw the billboard.
Gina!
What? Oh, that's the...
The guy we were talking to was him!
No!
Yes!
No!
Yes, it was! It has to be. It was him. It had to be because remember he said he had that sign in front of his house?
Oh.
And that's the website. Wait, he said he changed his name.
Did he?
Yeah, to the Saint. No. He picked the Saint Joseph.
You're right. It makes so much sense now. I went to hell and I made it back.
Mm-hmm.
Did drugs and stuff. But he still must believe in saving stuff for the future.
Clearly.
So yeah. Brother Joseph, who we had just spent so much time talking to at the shrine, was none other than Jeffrey Moss, the suspect in Father Kuntz's murder. But we hadn't known that while we were talking to him, so we hadn't asked him about Father Kuntz. By the time we pulled up at his house and realized it was the same guy, I was too flustered to actually knock on his door. I went back another time, but he wasn't there. So I called him on the phone. First, I asked him about the stolen statues.
At that time, you know, we were at the end of the millennium, you know, and there were certain Catholic prophecies. I'm Catholic. There were certain Catholic prophecies that said there's going to be a problem, maybe world war, you know, Fatima message, all that. So I ran into a little trouble because, guided by a priest, I borrowed a couple statues, see, and so I got in trouble. And then since I was in trouble, then they jumped on that opportunity to throw me into the mix.
I asked if he had known Father Kuntz.
Yeah, you know, on Father Kuntz, I never met him ever. And I did go to the church one time because I take pictures, I make videos, and they had some nice St. Michael pictures on the wall. And I went to one of his masses. And I certainly was, it was impossible in the timing. You know, I was involved somewhere far away at the time of the supposed whatever. So, and then I was stupid. I don't understand law, but I immediately volunteered my blood and my DNA and everything, you know. And then so from that, they were, I guess, able to clear me, you know. And then so, you know, I'm completely innocent and I wouldn't even step on an ant.
Don Johnson remembered Jeffrey Moss right away.
All I know is that we looked at him. We were trying to do a timeline of where he was to get him anywhere near our area. I don't think it worked. We didn't have anything of value that we found was missing. It just did not become a hot, juicy lead. It just got thrown in with the group doing burglaries for cash, for wine, or whatever. It just didn't go anywhere.
But there's another man with a history of theft who was still on their list. And his criminal record includes a lot worse things than borrowing some statues. That's next time on Unsolved. Before we go, I wanted to tell you about a new true crime podcast I think you'll like. It's called Case Closed, and it's made by our friends at Macmillan. Season 1 of Case Closed tells the story of Erin Corwin, a young military wife who was murdered in 2014. She was living with her husband, John, a Marine corporal who was stationed at 29 Palms in California, when she left to scout hiking trails in Joshua Tree National Park. She never came back. 2 months later, her body was found dumped in an abandoned mine shaft deep in the desert. Case Closed won't leave you wondering. By the end of the season, you'll find out who killed Erin Corwin and why. You can subscribe to Case Closed on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. Unsolved is reported, written, and produced by me, Gina Barton. Our sound engineer and videographer is Bill Schultz. Photographer, Mark Hoffman. Artist, Lou Saldivar. Web designers, Aaron Coy and Andrew Malika. Our editor of local news and investigations is Greg Borowski. Our copy editor is Debbie Davis. Our theme music this season was composed by Evan Johnson. The TV news clips you heard in this episode came from WKOW in Madison. I also want to thank Donna Billmeyer, Miles Moffitt, Ashley Lutheran, Meg Jones, Tom Ketting, Rachel Piper, Emily Risto, Anissa Johnson, Rick Wood, Brian Kranz, Joe Hanneman, Elena Weissman, and Taylor Palmby for their help this season. More information, along with photos and video, can be found on our website at jsonline.com/unsolved. And please support local journalism. You can subscribe to the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel at jsonline.com/deal. Thank you.